Welcome to The Odyssey, a podcast by and about Mesa County Libraries. My name is Emmy.
My name is Bethany. Special guests include staff members who share their various passions and community members who serve Mesa County.
Welcome, everyone, to this episode of The Odyssey. Today we have Dr. Melissa Connor, a professor at Colorado Mesa University and also the director of the Forensic Investigation Research
Station.
I was like, it's not center because it starts
with an
S. Yeah. Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us today.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
We're excited. Of course. Yes, we are very excited. I will say that this was a little bit selfish on my part.
Yeah, you're loving this stuff.
I love true crime kind of stuff. And so let's just say if I had another like 15 years of wanting to go to school, I would maybe go for
something. That'd be your next master's.
Yeah, but I'm done with school. So, so obviously we wanted to bring you in to talk about furs, but also to talk about your background because you've done some very interesting things throughout your career. So can you just start by telling us what your specialization is and how you got into that?
My specialization right now is forensic anthropology. I've been kind of an academic jack of all trades. I started out in archaeology and I worked in as an archaeologist for the National Park Service for 15 years.
Wow. Wow.
And part of that was in battlefield sites. I worked at Little Bighorn Battlefield. And we were using a laser transit and some other techniques that are old hat now, but then they were pretty new. So physical anthropologist Clyde Snow came up and was going to help us with the skeletal remains because we'd found some skeletal remains on the battlefield. And he said, oh, you guys have to take this to a real battlefield. He also worked for a group called Physicians for Human Rights, and or PHR. And PHR got the contract in 93 to go into the former Yugoslavia to investigate war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. So he had our team come with him, and I ended up working with fresh bodies there and just kept at it through PHR and a number of other entities. Quit the Park Service, started teaching at Nebraska Wesleyan University when PHR wasn't using me. They ended up hiring me to be director of their Master of Forensic Science program, and I taught there for a number of years. And then I saw the ad at CMU for a director of a body farm and came here in 2012.
Nice. How did you get into anthropology to begin with? Was it something that had interested you or when you were taking classes?
It had interested me, but to be honest, my first undergraduate major was journalism. But I took an anthropology course and took the archaeological field school. The next summer, they hired me back, and the summer after that, somebody else hired me. And somewhere in there, I figured, well, I can make a living doing this archaeology.
How serendipitous.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you brought up the Little Bighorn Battlefield, and I just wanted to get your perspective. We're recording this in November, which is Native American Heritage Month. And so I wanted to get your perspective on the implications that the project had for our understanding of Native Americans, especially during the Western expansion.
Well, I think I'll circle back to the battlefield as a smaller entity than the entire Western expansion. But I think we were able to show that definitely they had a broad array of weapons. The 7th Cavalry was outgunned. They understood using the terrain for warfare. They understood how to use all the small humps and hillocks all over the battlefield. And basically, Custer's men were outgunned, outfought, and out-strategized, which I think kind of surprised a lot of people. It was they had the Native Americans had won a battle prior to that at Rosebud Battlefield about 10 days prior to the Little Bighorn. And I think the work we did archaeologically, as well as what's still ongoing at Rosebud, is showing it wasn't a one-off. It wasn't a surprise. Mm-hmm. Those guys knew what they were doing. They were very strategic about it. And were the numbers a little bit more even, things could have turned out differently overall.
Wish Ike were here.
Yeah, right. Ike is our historian librarian, and so I'm sure you'd have a lot of great commentary on that.
For sure. You'd be like, here's these books where this is considered.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for giving us some perspective on that.
This fall, National Geographic's show Drain the Ocean had a Wild West episode.
Oh.
And a third of that's on the Little Bighorn Battlefield.
Hey. Oh, very cool.
Okay, we'll link that in the show notes yes, so we can find it.
And so we talked about Yugoslavia, right? Was there anywhere else that you worked at that you found particularly interesting? Any other sites?
All of the sites are interesting. I went with PHR, not only the former Yugoslavia, but they ended up working in Rwanda in 94, 95.
Ooh, whoa. Yeah.
So I did a couple of projects in Rwanda. I worked multiple times in Cyprus on those who went missing during the Turkish invasion / liberation. I worked a number of places like that. It was all interesting in different ways.
Yeah. Was it hard to go to these places where war crimes and genocide had occurred? Or was it mediated by the fact that you were helping them in some way, and so it was less hard?
Well, two aspects. One, yes, we're absolutely helping people, and it's really nice to see the reaction of the living when we're helping them find their dead relatives.
Their loved ones, yeah.
And two, in a broader perspective, find a place where crimes and genocide haven't happened.
That's true.
Fair point.
That is true. And if you are able to, that's probably inaccurate in some form.
Keep digging.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. The United States has its own history to work with there.
Yes. What is a common misconception about either anthropologists or forensic anthropologists?
One, we only work with bones. I certainly work with soft tissue decomposition. Mm-hmm. That's what we do out at the Forensic Investigation Research Station, is look at decomposition and the trajectory of it in different circumstances. So while I am not a pathologist who makes a medical determination on soft tissue, when it comes to how it decays, what's natural, what's not natural, that's part of our brief as a forensic anthropologist. The $20 word for that is taphonomy, so we study forensic taphonomy.
Mm. So the show Bones is not an accurate representation necessarily.
She did a little bit of taphonomy, but it's so inaccurate for so many other reasons.
Sure.
We had another guest on, and we're talking about just the misconception that the media puts out about your job.
Yes.
So what, like, and television shows in particular, like, are there shows that you can't watch that just make you so angry because they're not accurate? Is Bones one of them?
Not really. If it's got a good storyline, yeah. I'm willing to suspend disbelief.
Fair.
That's creative, yeah.
Going off of that, do you find that the popularization of forensic science through things like Bones or through other media has increased the interest of people getting into the field, maybe without knowing what it actually entails?
You know, honestly, those things have started to be around so long, it's hard to tell if it's actually increased it anymore. That interest is ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
The interest, Bethany, that you mentioned in true crime is huge.
It is.
I think in some ways it comes from a world in which people don't necessarily come face to face with real true crime, with real victims, with real the real trauma that portends. And that's part of what we have to do in education, is ensure that people understand what the reality is, as opposed to TV shows, that there are real victims who have real feelings and issues about all of the things that we work with.
Yeah. I feel like that's where I run into some some discomfort with the fact that I like true crime is the ethicality of it, the fact that we're selling these people's stories, worst moments of their lives, of their loved ones' lives, as entertainment. But at the same time, with the advancements in forensic science, I feel like understanding some of the things that we're able to do is helpful, not only to the field, but to other people investigating. So say, for instance, something in one crime happened, and then because they were able to get it out to the media, this other small investigation service in some county is like, oh, that's very similar to something that we had. We should use the same technique type of thing.
Yes. That's, I think, a really good positive of both the interest in it. I think as long as we keep the focus on the victims and don't make the perpetrators some kind of anti-hero.
Yeah, don't tell me their names. Just give me the justice, right?
Yep.
Then we can avoid what you're talking about.
Yes. Okay.
Man, that's good stuff.
What do you like the most about your job? And also, what is the most challenging part?
Probably about the same things. I like interacting with the live people, both the students and the families that we service who donate their relatives' remains to us. They're just a lot of fun and good people. On the other hand, they can be the most challenging part of the job, too. The dead people are not a challenge.
Yes. They're family
members. No complaints
on
their end, right?
Let's talk about the donation portion for a second, because that's how you're able to run the first station, right? So how does that work? How does somebody donate their body to forensic science?
Well, if you want to donate your own body, we have paperwork that allows you to sign your body to us. Mm-hmm. If you're within 75 miles of Grand Junction, we will pick you up and take the remains to first. We'll do cooler-to-cooler transport with our own vehicle, and otherwise we'll have a funeral home pick up the remains and bring them to us. If you're outside of that 75-mile limit, then really the estate has to
Make arrangements
for transport, because we don't have the funding, the manpower, the vehicles to really you know, have a fleet that goes out and picks up bodies all over the United States. That said, we've had a large number of donations from outside of our pickup area. We've got probably a handful from California, at least three or four where people have flown in.
Wow.
And so that doesn't seem to really, it is a barrier, but it's not a huge barrier for people who want to do this with their remains. The other way that we can receive bodies is your next of kin can donate your remains, or whoever legally has jurisdiction over your body can donate it to us. And then there's a set of paperwork for that.
What are some of the reasons that people are interested in donating their body to forensic science?
One is the true crime, like your interest, the true crime interest, where they want to be a part of that teaching process and exploration process, and they just think it would be cool. Some of it is that teaching process, the idea of being a postmortem educator. We don't, one of the things that differentiate the FERS body donation from anatomical donation is in anatomical donation, they'll embalm the body and use it for medical classes or biology classes. That embalming goes funky after a couple years, so they'll cremate the remains and give the cremains back. In our facility, we watch the body decay until the bones are kind of where they are showing, and then we bring them up in, clean it all up, and we study the skeletal material, and we use that for teaching and research. So the families get nothing back, but that skeleton gets used by generations of students.
It feels like the organic versus GMO approach of buying your produce.
What if somebody wanted to donate their organs? Because in Colorado, on your license, you can you can choose if you want to be an organ donator. So are they able to do that, but then also
donate to us? Donate absolutely.
Okay. Cool.
That's just too important not to find a way to work with.
Yeah.
So it may mean they're not in this study, but they might be in this study. Mm-hmm. And generally, at least part of their skeleton comes to us, so we have that resource to work with.
Wonderful. So you mentioned it a little bit earlier, the name The Body Farm. So I wanted to get your perspective on that, because they're often, the forensic research stations are referred to as body farms, and that was popularized by a 1994 novel called The Body Farm by Patricia Cornwell. But why is that nickname somewhat inaccurate for what you do?
Well, we don't really farm bodies.
Fair enough.
And aside from not actually farming bodies, there is a sense about whether or not it's disrespectful to our donors. And in that sense, I will take input from our donors on how they wish to refer to the facility. So if they refer to it as the body farm, that's fine. If they say, I want to send my mom to the body farm, then that's what I'll call it. If they feel that's kind of disrespectful and prefer a more academic term, like research facility, then that's what we should be using. More and more, I do find that our donors themselves are comfortable with the term body farm. So that makes me more comfortable with it as well.
Do you think it gives the general public a negative connotation of the body farm? Kind of like thinking about just, you know, bodies laying out in the field, and they might think that that's unsightly.
I think that's part of the disrespect that some people feel with that term. But as you said, it's been popularized by the media, by Patricia Cornwell's novel. There have been a number of popular articles, news articles, TV shows that show exactly what the research is. And so there's a group of people who have a good idea of what a body farm entails, and then people who might use the term less respectfully.
Got it.
When I was working for an advertising agency a couple of years ago, one of our clients was a local funeral home, and it was really interesting to just see people who were prepared for that time in life where it was time to get everything together and process, you know, what do I want to happen to my body after I'm done? And at one point, the funeral home, they hosted some sort of like mixer or like a chamber event. And I had to sit back because I was in such awe of the director at the time, because he's like, look, I've been doing this for 20 years, and some people really are comfortable talking about these things. And sometimes people, they're just so emotionally, you know, overwhelmed with having to take care of something that their loved one didn't quite have together. And being able to see the way that he would manage his emotions and make sure that, like, you're catering to how that person is responding. Like, if they're going to make jokes about it, then you can make jokes with them. But if they're not, like, so I think when you're in that line of industry, just playing to however that person wants to talk about it is the best way to do it. But also, you know, keeping respect, obviously, like, the number one thing.
For sure. So one of the reasons, aside from liking true crime, that I was interested in bringing you in is because for our community conversations series, we like to bring in people that add unique offerings to our communities or serve our communities in unique ways. And the FERS location is actually pretty unique because of where it's located. So can you give us some more information on what makes it unique?
Yes, actually, I can do that.
Perfect.
There are approximately, I think right now, 9 taphonomy facilities like this in the world.
Whoa.
One in Australia, one in Quebec, one, maybe two in Florida, two in Texas, mm-hmm. one in Illinois, one in Michigan. Most of the ones in the United States, oh, and of course, Tennessee, the granddaddy, the first facility was at Tennessee, and there's another at Cullowhee at Western Carolina University. Mm-hmm. So if you look at that geographic distribution, at least on North America, aside from the Australian facility, they're all over east half of the continent. Mm-hmm. We're on the west half, and if you look at any climate vegetation map, we're in a whole different climatic zone. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing a lot more desiccation from the aridity. And probably also the altitude. Mm-hmm. We are at approximately 5,000 feet above mean sea level. And I think the next highest facility at Cullowhee is in at about 1,200 feet above mean sea level. Whoa. We also have a satellite facility at Park County that the Park County coroner, David Kintz, helps us run with a graduate student out of Southern Illinois University, Chrissy Bajant. And we call that TB40, or which stands for the back 40.
Oh, okay.
So that's in Fair Play, outside of Fair Play, at about 10,000 feet above mean sea level. So with those two facilities, we really are looking at differences in altitude, mm-hmm. Which includes variables like solar radiation, the constant wind in Fair Play, and even mm-hmm. out at Whitewater helps to dry out the remains as well as the aridity in the desert out there.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And so that was that kind of CMU's motivation in bringing this project to this area, was that it was a unique offering not only for the field, but also for the school.
I think for the school, they really have an awesome criminal justice program. Mm-hmm. And they felt that this would enhance mm-hmm. those offerings, and we can bridge between social science and the sciences, the STEM sciences, and use that interest in criminal justice as a way to do that. So that's, I think, where some of their heads were. The fact that we are in an unusual environment for these is icing on the cake.
Is that what kind of drew you to this job when you saw it, was the unique opportunity it presented?
Yeah, absolutely. I had been, actually, since my work overseas and working with fresher bodies and taphonomy and trying to look at postmortem interval through those remains and what happened to graves. When I was teaching at Nebraska Wesleyan, I was actually burying pigs in my backyard. Oh. We had 5 acres, so the back three. Mm-hmm. I had pigs in, and then I was having classes dig them up.
Whoa.
And I thought, well, this will be cool. I can graduate from pigs to humans. And I bet I don't have to use my own car to transport the dead pigs. So I saw it as a step up. Yeah.
Solid resources. Wow.
How, aside from donating your body postmortem, how else can people get involved? So students can take courses, but can the general public also volunteer?
First of all, we don't take volunteers unless they've already been a student intern.
Got it.
Mm-hmm. There's just a lot of privacy issues, mm-hmm. a lot of data collection issues that would be really challenging for us to work with if from people just walking in off the street.
Right.
So generally, the workforce that we have is our interns, and we couldn't do it without them. We've got 3 this semester, but we'll have 5 to 6 interns next semester.
Nice. Awesome.
And generally over the summer, we have anywhere between 5 and 7, which is about what we can handle, mm-hmm. given our classroom and our facility. So those folks do photography, data collection. They work with the bones and clean them up. They do initial analyses. They are our workforce. Now, we do have two of our interns from last summer submitted abstracts to the American Academy of Forensic Sciences for February.
Whoa.
They were both accepted.
Congratulations.
So we've also had some other undergraduates present at the Academy meetings, which is an international forensic science meeting. And we're getting undergraduate students presenting at those, which I think is really cool.
That's fantastic.
So if you're a prospective student who's interested in forensic science, you should look at Mesa.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, what other places would you have an opportunity to gather photographs, lab, like just, and then submit it?
Yeah.
I'm sure
of
it's rare,
the facilities that we talked about, there's only two of us that work regularly with undergraduate students. Mm-hmm. That's Cullowhee, or the facility in Cullowhee, Western mm-hmm. Carolina, and us. The others all have graduate programs, and of course the graduate students have precedence in both research and actually working at the facility.
Wow. Yeah, getting your foot in the door for sure.
Yeah. Have you ever had a student, because I know that this would totally be me, I'd be like, oh, I'm so interested in this, and then I would go out there, but I have a very sensitive stomach, and I would immediately be like, I actually can't do this. Have you ever had somebody do that before?
Not really. I've had one that had a hard time making it through, and they came from another institution to intern. Our students, I can often work with and show pictures, show slides. Then they go out for one of my lower level classes just for a lab, for like a 2-hour exercise. And it's focused. It's not like you're just out here with the body.
Yeah.
You have this task, and this task. Mm-hmm. So I see it as a gradual desensitization over the course of generally about 2 years with students. And then by that time, I can send them out to do the full internship work and spend a lot more time with remains.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Just based on your personality in this conversation, it feels like you would acclimate them very well.
Yeah.
You're not going to throw somebody into the deep water. Like, good luck.
Yeah.
Well, and that's where we get, I think some of the worst reactions is if you just throw somebody in there as a surprise.
Yeah.
But for our students with both forensic anthropology and the criminal justice students even, I feel like their first time working with a dead body should not be on a crime scene or on a scene.
A traumatic event.
So if they can get that desensitization ahead of time. And we have a number of students who've gone on to become coroner's deputies.
Oh, cool.
As well as working with different jurisdictions from the criminal justice program. Then they're much better prepared to actually do their job when they get there.
Wow.
So we're not just training forensic anthropologists, because that's a narrow little field.
Yeah.
I do want to train those.
Yeah.
And we have a pretty good record of getting those folks into graduate school if they, you know, keep up the grades and do all the things they need to. But in order to broaden the students that we actually can train and work with, we work with biology students because there's any number of biological aspects of decomposition that we can study.
Mm-hmm.
Margot Bechtel, who's in the biology department, has been looking at the fungus on the bodies, which is a late-stage decomposer.
Wow.
Yeah.
There's so much you can get out of it.
Yeah.
So we have chemical aspects. We have biological aspects. We have photographic aspects, which the CJ students or criminal justice students can work with. And we have postmortem interval and other small projects that students from a broad variety of fields can work with.
Yeah. Didn't we had a previous employee here who interned there, Riley.
Riley.
Yeah.
And yes, you did.
Yeah. Wasn't she looking at insects, insect activity?
Yes, her interest was insects. And we have a partner with Cornell University, a gentleman named Elson Shields, works with us, and he's a tenured entomology professor at Cornell. So he's been collecting insects. Well, we collect them for him, and then they've been identifying them, try to work out the postmortem interval. And Riley was there at that time period, too, and helped collect remains. Well, helped collect insects from the remains.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
What a fun job.
Yeah, right. If you like bugs.
If you like bugs, yeah.
Yeah, all you have to do is like bugs and dead bodies.
Yeah. You know. And knowing Riley, her personality is very, like, very sweet and good-natured. And so when she was like, yeah, this is what I'm doing, I was like, oh, okay. So I was reading an article, and unfortunately I can't remember which one it was, but it was an interview that you had done where you talked about how elementary school teachers contacted you to do tours, your response was something like, it's an interesting thing, but maybe not for people that young.
5 and 6 year olds?
Oh, no. Yeah, so I just wanted to get your perspective on what that was like to have to tell the teacher, like, yeah, maybe not a great idea.
Well, again, I think probably it's not a great idea for younger mm-hmm. individuals mm-hmm. To go out and see rotting dead bodies.
Yeah,
it's fair.
Until there's some level, a little bit more level of maturity and intellectual curiosity mm-hmm. as opposed to like, okay, that's really gross.
Yeah.
And I have had contacts from the Boy Scouts, from mm-hmm. school teachers. And I have found that my best response is, do you know we put them out naked?
Oh.
And it's like, oh, well, they can't see that. That's okay.
Oh, my goodness.
We won't go. So dead bodies okay. Naked adults generally are where we can
all right.
convince some of the adults in charge of the children that perhaps it's not appropriate.
Interesting line.
That's fair.
Yeah, that's fair. That reminds me, my mom worked, she was a school teacher, and they went to the police station to do like a tour, and there were some grates on the floor, and one of the students, he was in first grade, I think, he asked, why are there grates on the floor? And the police officer said, so we can wash up their blood while they're in here. We can just wash it down the drain. And my mom was like, that probably not a great idea to tell a first grader that. Maybe just say, oh, just to clean some stuff up. So very interesting what some people think is maybe appropriate for young people versus what actually right. is appropriate. Have you had any requests just to see like the bones before?
Requests from who?
From like outside community members to do like a tour, but just to see the bones and not necessarily the actual process?
See, I consider bones human remains okay. as well.
Yeah.
So they're under the entire umbrella.
Okay, got it. So yeah. No distinction there.
Yeah, human remains go all the way up through the bones.
Yeah, that's fair.
From flesh to bones.
That's
yeah.
fair. Can, if people are interested, can they contact you? Not like school teachers, but let's say like
it's an appropriate audience.
Yeah, an appropriate audience contacted you.
There's two appropriate audiences, but that contact me. Mm-hmm. We've actually had family members come back to look at the bones of their relatives. And then the other audience is, of course, researchers.
Okay.
So we work with researchers from around the country. On skeletal material, mm-hmm. and we've got somebody looking at isotopes coming mm-hmm. in Friday, in fact, to Ooh. Do a collection from molars to see if they can look at the isotopes in the teeth and determine where those people were from.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
That is cool.
I love that so much.
Yeah.
But because we know where these people were from, we have some idea of their history mm-hmm. over their adult life, they're a great control group yeah. for that kind of research.
Because then you can test what the researcher found against what you actually know.
Exactly.
Okay. That's very cool. Can you give us some examples of some other studies that or some other researchers that have come in? We've talked about the insects and then the isotopes. What else is currently being worked on or has been worked on?
The fungus, again, Margot Bechtel. One of the things that we have is we have desiccated tissue for years. So we're working on how does that break down and what is the trajectory of that. So the fungus, of course, is a decomposer. That's one of the late-stage decomposers, and she's helping identify that. One of the things we worked on this summer that the students will be presenting on, and we had a student showcase also in the spring, is weathering of bone and whether you can look at that weathering and determine how long the bone has been out. There's a number of studies that say, yes, within these broad ranges, but our solar radiation, our environment is such that that bone just goes all the way to late stage weathering almost before the tissue's gone.
Wow.
So we're able to say, okay, maybe over here in Tennessee it works this way. Do not try that in Western Colorado. So we've got a couple of papers on that, and that's what kind of what they're presenting on at the Academy, and then we had one presentation last spring on that. The other thing I'm kind of looking at is now that we're getting a statistically significant sample of remains, what's the variation in when do they become skeletal? And is there any way to track it back to the postmortem interval given the amount of variation that we see, which is huge. And so what we've done is look at the people who really decompose a lot faster than others and then look back at their histories. And we're able to identify either disease processes or pathologies that may impact the connective tissues as to why they decompose so much faster. Then the later stage variation that we're looking at, we're relating to a season of deposition and microenvironment. And that seems to be causing a lot of that variation. So what we're trying to do is be able to lower that variation to the point that we could get a better prediction from what stage the body is at, how long they've been there.
Okay. So the COVID pandemic, right? There's still a lot that's unknown about it, but just hearing you talk about maybe some of the diseases or the pathologies that people experience in life and how that affects postmortem, we don't yet know how COVID affects people after death in terms of decomposition. So that's something I'm thinking about as you're talking, like what a unique, I'm going to say that word again, unique opportunity to have that station, but also unfortunately be in a global pandemic. But that gives you the ability to look at something that, you know, you haven't been able to necessarily because the flu was many, many years ago, the Spanish flu. So do you think, I don't know where I'm going with this. I lost my train of thought.
I think what you're trying to suggest is do COVID patients decay differently than other patients? And first of all, we haven't really taken COVID because we're just starting now, what, a year and a half into the pandemic, to really understand how long it lasts in human remains. And I'm not going to subject my students to
the
potential for
high
diseases coming from the remains. So we discriminate against individuals who have any kind of condition that may last postmortem.
That's fair.
Tuberculosis is a spore disease. Hepatitis lasts on surfaces forever. And so we've discriminated against COVID patients because of that.
Yeah, no, that's a valid safety precaution.
Yeah, our students are very good. They're learning universal precautions and how to handle these types of remains, but they're learning how to do it. They don't have 20 years experience.
Right, right.
So they're our first consideration is their safety. That said, COVID is a virus. Odds are it doesn't impact the remains much more than any other virus. The individuals that we've seen that go faster, again, it's a tends to be a connective tissue disorder often, whether it's a lupus or a type of burning on the skin. We did, kind of by mistake, take an individual with MRSA.
Oh, wow.
And that individual had a bacterial load like you wouldn't believe.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
And, yeah, she decomposed much, much quicker.
Mm-hmm.
But that was not intentional.
Kind of.
But once the individual was out in the facility, I made the executive decision that we were going to just leave that individual right there.
Yep.
Nobody else was going to touch
yeah.
until the bones were there.
That's fair.
Wow. Yeah.
Just on a side note, if a person's been vaccinated, would you take that as a donation? If they didn't die from COVID, does that make sense?
If they had active COVID, even if they didn't die from COVID,
mm-hmm.
because a number of people are dying from other
sure.
things, even if they yeah. are have active COVID mm-hmm. at the time, then no, we're not taking them.
Gotcha.
It doesn't really matter whether or not the individual is vaccinated. It depends on whether or not there's virus in the lungs.
Mm-hmm.
As you move bodies, those lungs can still expel. So we've been masking bodies even if there's no sign that they have COVID. Yeah.
Okay.
No, that makes a ton of sense. I was just curious.
Yeah. So, Melissa, I just wanted to thank you very much for coming on and also give you the opportunity if there's anything else that you would like to add before we close out this podcast.
Really think of anything, Bethany.
This has
thank
been a
you.
Solid conversation.
Yes, it has been. And so thank you again, and best of luck to you and your students in the future.
Thank you.